after severe infighting into an array of smaller and mutually hostile groups. It remained unclear how the public opinion within articulate elites, with direct access to the press, related to the attitudes prevailing among the masses of the population. War scares and jingo campaigns made good newspaper copy, but how socially deep were they? It was a grave mistake, the German consul general in Moscow warned in December 1912, to assume that the belligerence and Germanophobia of the Russian War Party and the Slavophile press were characteristic of the mood in the country, for these circles entertained only the loosest connection with the actual tendencies of Russian life. The problem with German newspaper coverage of these issues, the consul argued, was that it tended to be written by journalists with little experience of Russia and a very narrow range of elite social contacts. In May 1913, the Belgian minister in Paris, Baron Guillaume, acknowledged the efflorescence of a certain chauvinism in France. It could be observed not just in the nationalist papers, but also in the theatres, reviews, and café concerts, where numerous performances offered jingoistic fare that was calculated to overexcite spirits. But, he added, the true people of France do not approve of these manifestations. All the governments, with the exception of Britain, maintained press offices whose purpose was both to monitor and, where possible, to shape press coverage of issues touching on security and international relations. In Britain, the Foreign Secretary appears to have felt little need to convince, or even inform, the public of the merits of his policies, and there were no official efforts to influence the press. Many of the major newspapers received handsome subsidies, but these came from private or party political sources, rather than from government. This did not, of course, prevent a dense network of informal relationships from developing between Whitehall officials and key journalists. The picture in Italy was rather different. Giovanni Giolotti, prime minister for the fourth time, in 1911-14, made regular payments to at least 30 journalists in return for supportive coverage of his policies. The Russian foreign ministry acquired a press department in 1906, and from 1910 Sazonov orchestrated regular tea-time meetings at the ministry with the most important editors and Duma leaders. Relations between the Russian diplomats and some favoured newspapers were so close, one journalist reported in 1911, that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in St. Petersburg often seemed a mere branch office of the Novaya Vremya. The newspaper's editor, Jegorov, was often to be seen in the ministry's press bureau, and Nelidov, chief of the bureau and himself a former journalist, was a frequent visitor to the paper's editorial offices. In France, the relationship between diplomats and journalists was especially intimate. Nearly half of the foreign ministers of the Third Republic were former writers or journalists, and the lines of communication between foreign ministers and the press were almost always open. In December 1912, when he was Prime Minister of France, Raymond Poincaré even launched a new journal, La Politique étrangère, to promote his views on foreign policy across the French political elite. Semi-official newspapers and inspired articles planted in the domestic press to test the climate of opinion were familiar tools of continental diplomacy. Inspired journalism masqueraded as the autonomous expression of an independent press, but its effectiveness depended precisely on the suspicion among readers that it emanated from the seat of power. It was universally understood in Serbia, for example, that Samouprava represented the views of the government. The Norddeutsche Allgemeine Zeitung was considered the official organ of the German Foreign Office. In Russia, the government made its views known through its own semi-official journal, Rossiya, but also ran occasional inspired campaigns in other more popular papers like Novaya Vremya. The French Foreign Ministry, like the German, dispersed cash to journalists from a secret fund and maintained close ties with Le Temps and the Agence Havas, while using the less serious-minded Le Matin to launch trial balloons. Interventions of this kind could go wrong. Once it was known that a particular newspaper often carried inspired pieces, There was the risk that indiscreet, tendentious, or erroneous reports by the same paper would be mistaken for intentional signals from the government, as happened, for example, in February 1913, when Le Temps ran an article based on unauthorized leaks from an unnamed source, disclosing some of the details of recent government deliberations on French rearmament. Furious official denials followed. Russian Foreign Minister Izvolsky's efforts in 1908 to prepare Russian public opinion and the press for the news that Russia had approved the Austrian annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina proved totally inadequate to the force of the public response. And in 1914, Novaya Vremya, despite its previously intimate relationship with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, turned against Sazonov, accusing him of excessive timidity in the defence of Russian interests, possibly because it was now under the influence of the Ministry of War. In the aftermath of the Friedjung affair of 1909, when Austrian Foreign Minister Ehrenthal threw his weight behind a press campaign based on false allegations of treason against prominent Serbian politicians, the government was forced to sacrifice the head of the Foreign Ministry's literary bureau. His successor was sacked amid a storm of press and parliamentary criticism over the bungled Prochaska affair of the winter of 1912, when allegations of Serbian mistreatment of an Austrian consular official were likewise found to be bogus. Official manipulations of the press also took place across national borders. Early in 1905, the Russians were distributing around £8,000 a month to the Parisian press, in the hope of stimulating public support for a massive French loan. The French government subsidized pro-French newspapers in Italy and Spain during the conference at Algeciras, and during the Russo-Japanese and Balkan Wars, the Russians handed out huge bribes to French journalists. The Germans maintained a very modest fund for supporting friendly journalists in St. Petersburg and plied newspaper editors in London with subsidies in the hope, mostly disappointed, of obtaining more positive coverage of Germany. Inspired leader articles might also be formulated for the eyes of a foreign government. During the Morocco crisis of 1905, for example, Théophile Delcasse used thinly disguised press releases, divulging the details of British military planning, in order to intimidate the Germans. Here, the inspired press functioned as a form of deniable, sub-diplomatic international communication that could achieve a deterrent or motivating effect without binding anyone to a specific commitment. Had Delcasse himself issued a more explicit threat, he would have placed the British Foreign Office in an impossible position. In February 1912, the French ambassador in St. Petersburg, Georges Louis, dispatched the translation of an article in the Novaya Vremya with a covering letter noting that it reflected very accurately the opinion of Russian military circles. In this case, the inspired press enabled discreet organizations within the administration, here the Ministry of War, to broadcast their views without officially compromising the government. But it did sometimes occur that different ministries briefed the press in opposite directions, as in March 1914, when the Birzhevia Vedomosti, Stock Exchange News, published a leader piece, widely assumed to have been inspired by Sukhomlinov, announcing that Russia was ready for war and had abandoned the idea of a purely defensive strategy. Sazonov responded with a conciliatory counterpiece in the semi-official Rossiya. This was a classic case of parallel signalling. Sukhomlinov was reassuring the French of Russia's readiness and determination to fulfil its alliance obligations, while Sazonov's response was intended for the German and possibly British foreign offices. An article published in the Kölnische Zeitung at around the same time attributing aggressive intentions to St. Petersburg on account of the most recent hike in Russian military expenditure was almost certainly planted by the German Foreign Ministry in the hope of eliciting a clarifying Russian response. In areas where the European powers competed for local influence, the use of subsidized press organs to win friends and discredit the machinations of one's opponents was commonplace. The Germans worried about the immense influence of English money on the Russian press, and German envoys in Constantinople frequently complained of the dominance of the French-language press, whose subsidized leader writers did everything possible to incite hostility against us. In these contexts, the press was the instrument of foreign policy, not its determinant. But this did not prevent policymakers from taking the press seriously as an index of opinion. In the spring of 1912, Jules Cambon worried lest the chauvinism of the French press heighten the risk of conflict. "I wish that those Frenchmen whose profession it is to create or represent opinion would exercise restraint, and that they would not amuse themselves in playing with fire by speaking of inevitable war. There is nothing inevitable in this world." 6 months later, with the First Balkan War underway and Pan-Slav feeling rising high in parts of the Russian press, the Russian ambassador in Berlin feared, or at least claimed to fear, that the state of mind of the population of his country might dominate the conduct of his government. Ministers and diplomats, who were confident about the capacity of their own governments to shield the policy-making process from the vicissitudes of domestic published opinion, often doubted the ability of foreign governments to do the same. In the aftermath of the Agadir crisis of 1911, the German military leadership feared that nationalist agitation and reviving confidence in France might pressurize an otherwise peaceable government in Paris into launching a surprise attack on Germany. The fear that an essentially peaceable German leadership would be swept into a war on her neighbors by chauvinistic opinion leaders at home was in turn a frequently recurring theme in French policy discussions. The Russian government, in particular, was widely seen as susceptible to pressure from the public sphere, especially when this took the form of agitation on Balkan issues, and there was some truth in this view, as the course of the July crisis would show. But the Russians also viewed the parliamentary Western governments as acutely vulnerable to public pressure, precisely because they were democratically constituted, and the British encouraged this inference by suggesting, as Grey habitually did, that the course of the English government in a crisis must depend on the view taken by English public opinion. Statesmen frequently hid behind the claim that they were acting under the constraints imposed by opinion in their own country. In 1908-9, the French cautioned the Russians against starting a war over the Balkans, for example, on the grounds that this region was not important to the French public. Izvolsky got his own back in 1911, when he urged Paris, without forgetting to remind his French interlocutors of their earlier advice, to settle with the Germans on the grounds that Russia would have difficulty making its public opinion accept a war over Morocco. The Serbian ambassador in Vienna claimed in November 1912 that Prime Minister Nikola Pašić had no choice but to pursue an irredentist policy on behalf of his country. If instead he attempted to conciliate Austria, the War Party in Belgrade would sweep him from power and replace him with one of their own number, and Sazonov justified the Serbian leader's belligerent public postures by reference to the somewhat overwrought quality of Serbian opinion. Sazonov's claim to the German ambassador Portales in November 1912 that concern for public opinion obliged him to defend Serbia's interests against Austria-Hungary was entirely characteristic. He used the same argument to persuade the Romanians not to initiate a conflict with Bulgaria in January 1913. "Be very careful. If you wage war with Bulgaria, I will not be able to resist an overexcited public opinion." In reality, Sazonov had little respect for newspaper editors and leader writers, and believed that he understood Russian opinion better than the newspapers did. He was quite prepared, when necessary, to sail against the tide of press commentary, all the while exploiting jingoist campaigns at home to persuade the representatives of other powers that he was under pressure to take certain measures. The readers of dispatches often saw through these evasions. When reports reached Kaiser Wilhelm in 1908 and 1909, informing him that pro-Slav public opinion might push the Russian government into action over Bosnia-Herzegovina, he scribbled the word "bluff" in the margins. Nevertheless, the widespread assumption that foreign governments were under pressure to align themselves with their own domestic opinion meant that press reports were the bread and butter of diplomatic dispatches. Sheaves of newspaper cuttings and translations fattened the files flowing into foreign ministries from every European legation. The efforts of all governments, by one means or another, to shape published opinion enhanced the importance of press monitoring, because it opened up the possibility that the press might provide the key, if not to public opinion, then at least to the opinion and intentions of the government. Thus, Gray saw in the anti-British press campaigns of the Agadir crisis in September 1911 a tactical manoeuvre by the German government designed to mobilise support for further naval bills in the coming Reichstag elections, while the Austrian ambassador accused the Russian foreign minister of encouraging negative coverage of Austro-Russian efforts towards détente after the Bosnian crisis. Diplomats constantly sifted through the press, looking for the inspired pieces that might provide the key to the thinking of this or that ministry. But since most governments used a range of organs, it was often difficult to know for sure whether a specific article was inspired or not. In May 1910, for example, when the French newspaper Le Temps published an article sharply criticizing the latest Russian troop deployment plans, the Russian Foreign Ministry assumed, wrongly as it happened in this case, that the piece was officially inspired and forwarded a protest to Paris. "It was a mistake," the German ambassador in Paris wrote, "always to assume that the views expressed in Le Temps reflected those of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or of the government. Its editor, André Tardieu, had sometimes fallen out with the authorities on account of his heterodox declarations on matters of national interest." In January 1914, the Belgian minister in Paris warned his government that while the big political leaders in Le Temps were generally the work of Tardieu, they were usually inspired by the Russian ambassador Izvolsky. This haze of uncertainty meant not only that embassy officials had to be vigilant in trawling the press, but also that adverse published comment on foreign governments could give rise on occasion to feuds in which two foreign ministries skirmished through the pages of the inspired press, in the process stirring public emotions in ways that could be difficult to control. The British and the German foreign offices were typical in the tendency of each to overstate the extent to which public opinion was controlled by the other government. Press feuds could also spring up spontaneously, without government involvement. It was widely acknowledged by the government that slanging matches between chauvinistic newspaper editors could escalate to the point where they threatened to poison the atmosphere of international relations. At a meeting that took place in Roval in June 1908, between Tsar Nicholas II, King Edward VII, and Charles Harding, the Tsar confided to Harding that the liberty of the Russian press had caused him and his government considerable embarrassment, since every incident that occurred in any distant province of the empire, such as an earthquake or thunderstorms, was at once put down to Germany's account, and serious complaints had recently been made to him and the government of the unfriendly tone of the Russian press. But the Tsar confessed that he felt unable to remedy this state of affairs except by an occasional official communique to the press, and this had generally but slight effect. He wished very much that the press would turn their attention to internal rather than foreign affairs. Between 1896, when the British newspapers responded with outrage to the Kaiser's Kruger telegram, and 1911, when the British and German papers clashed over events in Morocco, there were repeated press wars between Britain and Germany. Efforts by the two governments to achieve press disarmament in 1906 and 1907 by exchanging delegations of senior journalists were largely ineffective. Press wars were possible because the newspapers in each state frequently reported on the attitudes adopted by foreign newspapers on questions of national interest. It was not uncommon for entire articles to be reprinted or paraphrased. Thus, Tatishchev, the Russian military plenipotentiary in Berlin, could report to Tsar Nicholas II in February 1913 that Pan-Slavist articles in Novoye Vremya were making a distressing impression in Germany. International press relations were especially tense between Austria and Serbia, where the major papers watched their counterparts across the border with eagle eyes, or were supplied with cuttings and translations by their respective foreign ministries, and where complaints about press coverage on the other side of the border were a stock theme. This problem would play a prominent role in the diplomacy of the July crisis in 1914. It is questionable, nonetheless, whether the European press was becoming steadily more bellicose in the years before 1914. Recent research on the German newspapers suggests a more complex picture. A study of German press coverage during a sequence of major pre-war crises, Morocco, Bosnia, Agadir, the Balkans, etc., discerned an increasingly polarized view of international relations and a declining confidence in diplomatic solutions. But there were also periods of quiescence in between, and the era of the Anglo-German press wars came to an abrupt halt in 1912. The last two pre-war years were a period, by contrast, of unusual harmony and peacefulness. Even Friedrich von Bernhardi, whose Germany and the Next War, 1911, is often cited as an example of the increasing bellicosity of German opinion, opened his appallingly aggressive tract with a long passage lamenting the pacifism of his compatriots. Nor did chauvinism always speak with one voice. In Britain, anti-Russian sentiment was still a powerful public force in the last few years before the outbreak of war, notwithstanding the Anglo-Russian Convention of 1907. In the winter of 1911-12, as the Agadir crisis was subsiding, the rank and file of the Liberal Party accused Grey of seeking an excessive intimacy with Russia at the expense of a more cooperative relationship with Germany. The public meetings convened up and down the country at the end of January 1912 to demand an Anglo-German understanding were driven in part by hostility to Russia, whose machinations were seen as threatening British interests at numerous points along the imperial periphery. Politicians often spoke, or complained, of opinion as an external force pressing on government. In doing so, they implied that opinion, whether public or published, was something outside government, like a fog pressing on the window panes of ministerial offices, something that policymakers could choose to exclude from their own sphere of action. And by opinion, they mostly meant the public approval or rejection of their own persons and policies. But there is something deeper than opinion, something we could call mentality, a fabric of unspoken assumptions, as James Joll called it, that shaped the attitudes and behavior of statesmen, legislators, and publicists alike. In this domain, we can perhaps discern a deepening readiness for war across Europe, particularly within the educated elites. This did not take the form of bloodthirsty calls for violence against another state, but rather of a defensive patriotism that encompassed the possibility of war without necessarily welcoming it, a viewpoint underpinned by the conviction that conflict was a natural feature of international politics. "The idea of a prolonged peace is an idle dream," wrote Viscount Isher, a promoter of the Anglo-French Entente and a close friend and advisor of Edward VII in 1910. 2 years later, he told an audience of Cambridge undergraduates not to underestimate the poetic and romantic aspects of the clash of arms, warning that to do so would be to display an enfeebled spirit and an impoverished imagination. War, Henry Spencer Wilkinson, the Cicelli Professor of Military History at Oxford, observed in his inaugural lecture, was one of the modes of human intercourse. This fatalistic acceptance of war's inevitability was held in place by a loose assemblage of arguments and attitudes. Some argued from Darwinian or Huxleyite principles that in view of their energy and ambition, England and Germany were bound to come to blows, notwithstanding their close racial kinship. Others claimed that turmoil was a natural feature of highly developed civilizations with their sophisticated armaments. Yet others hailed war as therapeutic, as beneficial to society and a force for social advance. Underpinning the reception of such views in both Britain and Germany was a sacrificial ideology, nourished in turn by the positive depictions of military conflict to be found in newspapers and the books read by boys of school age. A pamphlet penned by a belligerent clergyman from New Zealand and published by the National Service League urged every schoolboy to recall that he stands between his mother and his sisters, his sweetheart and girlfriends, and all the women he meets and sees, and the inconceivable infamy of alien invasion. Even the Scouting movement, founded in 1908, possessed from its inception, notwithstanding its celebration of woodlaw, campfires, and outdoor adventure, a strong military identification which was emphasized throughout the pre-war period. In Russia, the years following the Russo-Japanese War witnessed a military renaissance driven by the desire for military reform. In 1910, 572 new titles on military subjects were published. Most of these were not warmongering tracts, but political interventions in the debate over how the reform of the Russian military should be linked to broader processes of social change that would orient society towards the sacrifices demanded by a major war effort. These developments, which had their counterparts in all the European states, helped to explain the readiness of the legislatures to accept the financial burden of increased armaments expenditure during the pre-war period. In France, the support of the Chamber of Deputies, after heated controversy, for the new three-year military service law in 1913, reflected the revived prestige of war in a public sphere that had tended, since the Dreyfus affair, to exhibit a strong anti-militarist ethos, though we should not forget that radical deputies supported this law in part because, for the first time, it would be financed by a progressive property tax. In Germany, too, Bethmann Hollweg managed to secure centre-right support for the massive army bill of 1913. For the separate bill to fund these measures, he was able to capture a centre-left coalition, though only because he was willing to raise part of the money by levying a new tax on the property-owning classes. In both cases, arguments for heightened military preparedness had to be admixed with other socio-political incentives in order to secure the support needed to drive these huge bills through Parliament. In Russia, by contrast, the enthusiasm of the political elite for armaments was such after 1908 that the Duma approved allocations even faster than the military commanders could work out what to do with them. Here it was the Oktoberist bloc in the Duma, not the ministers, who initially drove the campaign for Russian army expansion. In Britain, too, the prevalent mood of defensive patriotism left its mark on the legislature, whereas in 1902 only three MPs supported the National Service League, by 1912 the figure had risen to 180. The press entered into the calculations of policymakers in many different ways. It was never under their control, and they were never under its control. We should speak rather of a reciprocity between public opinion and public life, a process of constant interaction in which policymakers sought intermittently to guide opinion in a congenial direction, but were careful to shield their own autonomy and to protect the integrity of decision-making processes. On the other hand, statesmen continued to view the foreign press as an indicator not just of public opinion, but of official views and intentions, and this meant that uncertainties about who was inspiring or licensing which utterances could further complicate communications between states. More fundamental and more difficult to measure were the shifts in mentality that articulated themselves not in the calls of chauvinists for firmness or confrontation, but in a deep and widespread readiness to accept war, conceived as a certainty imposed by the nature of international relations. The weight of this accumulated readiness would manifest itself during the July crisis of 1914, not in the form of aggressive programmatic statements, but through the eloquent silence of those civilian leaders who, in a better world, might have been expected to point out that a war between great powers would be the very worst of things. The fluidity of power. Even if we were to assume that the foreign policies of the pre-war European powers were formulated and managed by compact executives animated by a unified and coherent purpose, Reconstructing the relations among them would still be a daunting task, given that no relationship between any two powers can be fully understood without reference to relations with all of the others. But in the Europe of 1903-14, the reality was even more complex than the international model would suggest. The chaotic interventions of monarchs, ambiguous relationships between civil and military, adversarial competition among key politicians in systems characterized by low levels of ministerial or cabinet solidarity, compounded by the agitations of a critical mass press against a background of intermittent crisis and heightened tension over security issues, made this a period of unprecedented uncertainty in international relations. The policy oscillations and mixed signaling that resulted made it difficult not just for historians, but for the statesmen of the last pre-war years to read the international environment. It would be a mistake to push this observation too far. All complex political executives, even authoritarian ones, are subject to inattentions and oscillations. The literature on 20th century U.S. foreign relations dwells at length on intra-governmental power struggles and intrigues. In a brilliant study of the U.S. entry into the Vietnam War, Andrew Preston shows that while Presidents Lyndon B. Johnson and John F. Kennedy were reluctant to wage war and the State Department was largely opposed to intervention, the smaller and more nimble National Security Council, which strongly favored war and operated beyond congressional oversight, narrowed down the president's options on Vietnam until war was virtually unavoidable. Yet the situation in pre-First World War Europe was different, and worse, in one important respect. For all the tensions that may evolve within it, the American executive is actually, in constitutional terms, a very tightly focused organization in which responsibility for executive decisions in foreign policy ultimately falls unambiguously upon the president. This was not the case for the pre-war European governments. There were perennial doubts about whether Grey had the right to commit himself as he did without consulting the cabinet or parliament. Indeed, these doubts were so pressing that they prevented him from making a clear and unequivocal statement of his intentions. The situation was even fuzzier in France, where the balance of initiative between the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the cabinet, and the presidency remained unresolved, and even the masterful and determined Poincaré faced efforts to shut him out of the decision-making process altogether in the spring of 1914. In Austria-Hungary, and to a lesser extent in Russia, the power to shape foreign policy flowed around a loose human circuitry within the hive-like structure of the political elite, concentrating at different parts of the system, depending upon who formed the more effective and determined alignments. In these cases, as in Germany, the presence of an all-highest sovereign did not clarify, but rather blurred the power relations within the system. It is not a question, as in the Cuban Missile Crisis, of reconstructing the ratiocinations of two superpowers sifting through their options, but of understanding sustained rapid-fire interactions between executive structures with a relatively poor understanding of each other's intentions, operating with low levels of confidence and trust, even within the respective alliances, and with high levels of hostility and paranoia. The volatility inherent in such a constellation was heightened by the fluidity of power within each executive, and its tendency to migrate from one node in the system to another. It may be true that dissent and polemics within the diplomatic services could have a salutary effect, in that they raised questions and objections that might have been suppressed in a more disciplined policy environment. But the risks surely outweighed the benefits. When hawks dominated the signaling process on both sides of a potentially conflictual interaction, as happened in the Agadir crisis and would happen again after the 28th of June 1914, swift and unpredictable escalations could be the result. 5. Balkan entanglements. The First World War was the Third Balkan War before it became the First World War. How was this possible? Conflicts and crises on the southeastern periphery, where the Ottoman Empire abutted Christian Europe, were nothing new. The European system had always accommodated them without endangering the peace of the continent as a whole. But the last years before 1914 saw fundamental change. In the autumn of 1911, Italy launched a war of conquest on an African province of the Ottoman Empire, triggering a chain of opportunist assaults on Ottoman territories across the Balkans. The system of geopolitical balances that had enabled local conflicts to be contained was swept away. In the aftermath of the two Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913, Austria-Hungary faced a new and threatening situation on its southeastern periphery, while the retreat of Ottoman power raised strategic questions that Russian diplomats and policymakers found it impossible to ignore. The two continental alliance blocs were drawn deeper into the antipathies of a region that was entering a period of unprecedented volatility. In the process, the conflicts of the Balkan theater became tightly intertwined with the geopolitics of the European system, creating a set of escalatory mechanisms that would enable a conflict of Balkan inception to engulf the continent within 5 weeks in the summer of 1914. Airstrikes on Libya. Early on the morning of the 5th of January 1912, George Frederick Abbott was woken in his tent in the Libyan desert by shouting and gunfire. Running out into the sunshine, he saw the Arab and Turkish soldiers of his encampment staring at something in the sky. It was an Italian monoplane flying at 2,000 feet, its wings touched by the rays of the morning sun. Heedless of the rifle fire from the camp, the plane sailed off gracefully to the southwest. The Italian invasion of Libya was in its fourth month. Turkophile by sentiment, Abbott had joined the Ottoman forces there as a British observer with the intention of writing a history of the campaign. He noted that the Arabs, beyond letting off their guns, appeared unimpressed by the flying machine. They have an enormous capacity for taking new things as a matter of course. When the plane returned a day later, it bombarded the encampment with bundles of proclamations, which fluttered in the sunlight like so many flakes of toy snow. The Arabs, Abbott recalled, left off firing and, stooping, picked up the sheets eagerly, in the hope that they might be banknotes. Abbott's Ottoman companions were lucky to be bombarded only with verbose Italian war propaganda in antiquated Arabic. Elsewhere, the gross technological imbalance between the Italian armed forces and the Ottoman subjects whose provinces they were invading had more lethal effects. Before many major actions in the Libyan war, aeroplanes went up in reconnaissance, signaling the enemy's position and strength so that the Italians could shell the Turkish guns from field batteries or from ironclads moored offshore. This was the first war to see aerial bombardments. In February 1912, an Ottoman retreat between the Zanzur oasis and Gagaresh to the southeast of Tripoli became a rout when the Italian dirigible P-3 dropped bombs among the retiring troops. Dirigibles could carry up to 250 bombs charged with high explosive. Bombs were dropped in small numbers from aeroplanes too, though this was an awkward business, since the aviator had somehow to steer the machine while gripping the bomb between his knees and using his free hand to insert the fuse before aiming it at the troops below. The military searchlight, though a less new technology, the Royal Navy had used searchlights against Egyptian forces in Alexandria as early as 1882, was another high-tech weapon that figured prominently in contemporary accounts of the Libyan War. It was probably of even greater tactical significance than the planes and dirigibles, since its use prevented the Ottoman forces from mounting night attacks, or at least made these far more costly in casualties. The British observer Ernest Bennett recalled picking his way with a small group of Arab fighters along a coastal path towards their bivouac at Bir Terim, when the party were suddenly pinpointed by the searchlight of an Italian cruiser. The sight of the poor Arabs silhouetted against the electric rays saddened me. Searchlights, Maxims, batteries, warships, aeroplanes, the odds seemed so terrible. The cascade of wars that brought mayhem to the Balkans began in Africa. It was the Italian attack on Libya in 1911 that flashed the green lights for the all-out Balkan assault on the Ottoman periphery. Unlike Egypt, now British, and Morocco, now effectively French, the three vilayets, later known as Libya, were integral provinces of the Ottoman Empire. The totally unprovoked Italian attack on these last Ottoman African possessions broke the ice, as one contemporary British observer put it, for the Balkan states. There had been talk for some years of a joint campaign to drive the Turks out of the Balkans, but nothing in the way of practical measures. Only after Italy's assault were the Balkan states emboldened to take up arms. Looking back on these events in 1924, Miroslav Spolajković, the former political head of the Serbian Foreign Ministry in Belgrade, recalled that it was the Italian attack on Tripoli that had inaugurated the process that had led to the war. All subsequent events are nothing more than the evolution of that first aggression. Italian diplomacy had been trying to secure an Italian sphere of interest in North Africa since before the turn of the century. In the summer of 1902, under the terms of the Prinetti-Barrère Accord, Rome and Paris had secretly agreed that in the event of a major redistribution of territory, France would take Morocco while Italy would be granted a free hand in Libya. The agreement ratified a process of rapprochement with France, the arch-rival in northern Africa, that had been underway since 1898. A note from London in March 1902 helpfully promised that Britain would ensure that any alteration in the status of Libya would be in conformity with Italian interests. These agreements exemplify a policy of concessions that was designed to loosen the hold of the Triple Alliance on Italy, its most unreliable component. It was in keeping with this approach that Tsar Nicholas II agreed the Racconigi bargain of 1909 with King Victor Emmanuel III, in which Russia acknowledged Italy's special interest in Libya in return for Italian support for Russian policy on access to the Turkish Straits. Selling a policy of invasion and annexation to the politically active part of the Italian public was not difficult. Colonialism was on the march in Italy, as it was elsewhere, and the memory of Roman Africa, when Libya had been the breadbasket of the empire, assured Tripolitania a central place on the kingdom's colonial horizons. In 1908, the modest Ufficio Coloniale in Rome was expanded and upgraded to the Direzione Centrale degli Affari Coloniali, a sign of the growing weight of African concerns within government. From 1909 onwards, the nationalist Enrico Corradini, supported by the nationalist organ L'Idea Nazionale, campaigned energetically for an imperialist enterprise focused on Libya. By the spring of 1911, he was openly demanding a policy of invasion and seizure. It was widely believed within the political elite that Italy needed somewhere fruitful in which to plant her departing emigrants. Even the socialists were susceptible to these arguments, though they tended to shroud them in the language of economic necessity. Until the summer of 1911, however, Italy's leading statesmen remained faithful to the country's ancient axiom that Italy must not provoke the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. As late as the summer of 1911, Prime Minister Giovanni Giolitti was still firmly rejecting calls to adopt a more aggressive position vis-à-vis Constantinople on a range of issues relating to the governance of Ottoman Albania. It was the French intervention in Morocco that changed everything. The Italian Foreign Ministry believed it had excellent grounds for demanding a quid pro quo in Libya. In view of France's radical modification of the situation in the Mediterranean, it would now be impossible, an Italian Foreign Ministry senior official pointed out, to justify a policy of continuing inaction before public opinion. It was Britain, France, and Russia, the powers of the Entente, rather than Italy's allies within the Triple Alliance, that encouraged Rome to take action. In early July 1911, the Italians mentioned to the British government the vexations supposedly visited upon Italian subjects in Tripoli by the Ottoman authorities. It was standard practice for European powers to legitimate their predations with the claim that their presence was needed to protect their nationals from ill-treatment. On the 28th of July, when the question of an actual intervention was raised with the Foreign Secretary by the Italian ambassador in London, Marquis Giulielmo Imperiali, Grey's reaction was astonishingly favourable. Grey desired to sympathise with Italy, he told the ambassador, in view of the very good relations between us. If the Italians were receiving unfair treatment in Tripoli, and should the hand of Italy be forced, Grey undertook to express to the Turks the opinion that, in face of the unfair treatment meted out to Italians, the Turkish government could not expect anything else. Unsurprisingly, the Italians read these obfuscating formulations as a green light for an attack on Libya. And Grey remained faithful to this line. On the 19th of September, he instructed permanent Under-Secretary of State Sir Arthur Nicholson that it was most important that neither England nor France obstruct Italy in her designs. Italian inquiries in St. Petersburg produced an even more accommodating response. The Italian ambassador to St. Petersburg was told that Russia would not complain if Italy acquired Libya. Indeed, St. Petersburg urged Italy to act in a prompt and resolute manner. There was thus intensive prior discussion with the Entente states. By contrast, Italy treated its allies in the Triple Alliance with a cavalier disregard. On the 14th of September, Giolitti and the Marquis di San Giuliano, Haley's foreign minister, met in Rome to agree that a military action should be launched as swiftly as possible, so that it would be underway before the Austrian and German governments were aware of it. This reticence was well advised, for the Germans had no wish to see their Italian ally go to war against their Ottoman friends, and were already doing what they could to achieve a peaceful resolution of the issues outstanding between Rome and Constantinople. The German ambassador in the Ottoman capital even warned his Italian colleague that an Italian occupation of Libya might bring down the Young Turk regime and trigger a sequence of disorders that would reopen the entire Eastern question. The Austrian foreign minister, Count Ehrenthal, repeatedly urged restraint on the Italians, warning them that precipitous action in Libya could have undesirable consequences on the Balkan Peninsula, and reminding them that they themselves had always proclaimed that the stability and integrity of the Ottoman Empire were in Italy's best interests. San Giuliano was fully aware of the contradictions in Italy's policy and cognizant of the undesirable consequences that worried the Austrians. In a long report of the 28th of July 1911 to the King and Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister weighed up the arguments for and against an invasion. He acknowledged the probability that the damage inflicted on the prestige of the Ottoman Empire would induce the Balkan peoples to action against it and hasten a crisis that might almost force Austria to act in the Balkans. The train of thought underlying these prescient comments was not solicitude for the security of the Austro-Hungarian Empire as such, but rather apprehension at the possibility that a wave of upheavals might favour Austrian Balkan interests at Italy's expense, especially in Albania, which was viewed in many quarters as yet another future Italian colony. Yet these Balkan dangers were balanced in San Giuliano's mind by the thought that time might be running out for an Italian venture in northern Africa. If political causes do not weaken or dissolve the Ottoman Empire, it, within 2 or 3 years, will have a powerful fleet that would render more difficult for us, and perhaps even impossible, an enterprise against Tripoli. The most striking feature of this last argument is the total absence of any foundation for it. The Ottoman government was, to be sure, striving to upgrade its obsolete fleet. An order had been placed for one modern battleship from England, and another was in preparation for a purchase from Brazil. But these modest efforts were dwarfed by Italian naval construction plans, not to mention the current strength of the Italian fleet, and there was no reason to suppose that they would ever unsettle Italy's comfortable naval superiority over the Ottomans in the eastern Mediterranean. San Giuliano's argument was thus founded less in the facts of the naval balance of power than in a kind of temporal claustrophobia that we find at work in the reasoning of many European statesmen of this era, a sense that time was running out, that in an environment where assets were waning and threats were growing, any delay was sure to bring severe penalties. So it was that, after a sequence of minor naval skirmishes, The signal to stand by rang out on the 3rd of October 1911 across a squadron of Italian warships moored before Tripoli Harbour. An Italian commander on board one of the ships recalled a rush of gunners to guns, of carriers to ammunition rooms, of signalmen to the speaking tubes. Ammunition lifts raised to the batteries the white shells, tipped with red, which were laid out in neat lines behind each gun. At exactly 3:13 in the afternoon, the Benedetto Brin fired the first shell at the red fort that stood on the spit of land enclosing Tripoli Harbour. It was the signal for a gigantic volley that boomed across the sea in clouds of white smoke. The city of Tripoli fell after perfunctory resistance and was occupied by 1,700 Italian marines only 48 hours after the commencement of hostilities. The occupations of Tobruk, Derna, Benghazi, and Homs followed over the next few weeks. In the following months, Italian troops, 20,000 at first, later increasing to 100,000, descended on the thinly defended vilayet of Tripolitania. The rapid liquidation San Giuliano had hoped for did not come about. The Italians found it difficult to break into the interior of the country, and for the first 6 months of the war remained confined to their coastal bridgeheads. An Italian decree of the 5th of November, formally announcing the annexation of Tripolitania and Cyrenaica, was a gesture intended to preempt premature mediation by the other powers, not a faithful reflection of the military situation. In a succession of naval actions off the Lebanese coast in January and February 1912, the Italians destroyed the Ottoman naval presence at Beirut and eliminated the only remaining threat to Italian naval dominance in the southern Mediterranean. But the land war dragged on amid hair-raising reports of Italian atrocities against the Arab population. Despite their technological inferiority, the Ottoman defenders and their auxiliaries inflicted bruising defeats on the invaders. A series of concentric Turco-Arab attacks on the Italian perimeter around Tripoli during the first month of the war broke through the lines at various points, destroying some units and exacting high casualties, while armed rebels inside the perimeter harassed the defending forces from behind. Throughout the conflict, small skirmishes, ambushes, and guerrilla warfare impeded movement between the main coastal strongholds or into the interior. It would take the Italians 20 years to pacify the Libyan hinterland. San Giuliano had seen that the invasion and seizure of Libya might have a disinhibiting effect on the Christian states of the Balkan Peninsula. If this outcome was probable after the initial invasion, it became inevitable when Italy attempted to break the stalemate on land by taking the sea war into Ottoman home waters. On the 18th of April 1912, Italian gunboats bombarded the two outer forts guarding the entrance to the Turkish Straits. The gun crews fired 346 shells from moorings 7 miles offshore, killing one soldier and one horse and damaging a barrack. It was a symbolic demonstration rather than a real blow at the enemy's military strength. The Turks responded, predictably enough, by closing the straits to neutral commerce. 10 days later, there was a further naval attack on the Dodecanese Islands at the southern end of the Aegean Sea. Between the 28th of April and the 21st of May 1912, the Italians seized control of 13 islands, whose Greek natives greeted them as heroes and liberators. After a lull, the Italians stepped up the pressure in July, sending 8 submarines into the straits. Once again, there was talk of a Turkish closure, though on this occasion Constantinople agreed under Russian pressure merely to narrow the width of the channel by laying mines. In October 1912, the Italian government threatened to launch a major naval campaign in the Aegean if the Ottoman government did not agree to conclude a peace. Under pressure from the great powers, and especially Russia and Austria, who were concerned respectively by the disruption to shipping and the growing danger of Balkan complications, the Turks finally caved in and signed a secret peace treaty on the 15th of October, stipulating the autonomy of Tripolitania and Cyrenaica. An imperial ferman, decree, of the same date announced the withdrawal of Ottoman direct rule from the lost provinces. 3 days later, this arrangement was publicly confirmed in the Treaty of Lausanne. The Italo-Turkish War, today largely forgotten, disturbed the European and international system in significant ways. The Libyan struggle against the Italian occupation was one of the crucial early catalysts in the emergence of modern Arab nationalism. It was the powers of the Entente that had encouraged Italy to this bold act of unprovoked predation, while Italy's partners in the Triple Alliance reluctantly acquiesced. There was something revelatory in this constellation. The interventions of the powers exposed the weakness, indeed the incoherence, of the Triple Alliance. The repeated warnings from Austria and Berlin that Italy's action would unsettle the entire Balkan Peninsula in dangerous and unpredictable ways were ignored. Italy, it seemed, was an ally in name only. There was as yet no overt hint of Italy's later defection to the Entente. Italian foreign policy still played a complex and ambiguous game in which contradictory commitments were precariously balanced. The traditional rivalry with France over northern Africa still seethed below the surface. Sensational naval incidents, such as the impounding by Italian naval craft of French steamers suspected of carrying Turkish arms and military personnel, ensured that the war stirred mutual bitterness and paranoia between Italy and its long-resented Latin sorellastra, stepsister. Nonetheless, the war confirmed an insight of great importance to Paris and London, namely that Italy was, for the moment, a more valuable asset to the Entente inside the Triple Alliance than outside it. In a letter of January 1912 to Premier Raymond Poincaré, Paul Cambon noted that Italy was more burdensome than useful as an ally. Against Austria, she harbours a latent hostility that nothing can disarm, and, as regards France, we have reasons to think that in the event of a conflict, she would remain neutral, or more likely would await events before taking part. It is thus unnecessary for us to attach her more closely to us. Underlying the disarray of the Triple Alliance was a development of even more fundamental importance. In mounting her assault on Libya, Italy had the more or less reluctant support of most of Europe. This in itself was a noteworthy state of affairs, for it revealed how comprehensively the pro-Ottoman European coalition had dissolved. In the 1850s, a concert of powers had emerged to contain Russian predations against the Ottoman Empire. The result was the Crimean War. This grouping had reconstituted itself in different form after the Russo-Turkish War at the Conference of Berlin in 1878, and had regrouped during the Bulgarian crises of the mid-1880s. It was now nowhere to be seen. In the opening phase of the Italian War, the Ottoman Empire had sought an English alliance, but London, reluctant to alienate Italy, did not respond. The two Balkan Wars that followed then broke the concert beyond repair. A transition of profound significance was taking place. Britain was gradually withdrawing from its century-long commitment to bottle the Russians into the Black Sea by sustaining the integrity of the Ottoman Empire. To be sure, British suspicion of Russia was still too intense to permit a complete relaxation of vigilance on the Straits. Grey refused in 1908 to accede to Izvolsky's request for a loosening of the restrictions on Russian access to the Turkish Straits, notwithstanding the Anglo-Russian Convention signed in the previous year. Right up until 1914, the Ottoman fleet on the Bosphorus was still commanded by a Briton, Admiral Sir Arthur Henry Limpus. But the gradual loosening of the British commitment to the Ottoman system created by degrees a geopolitical vacuum, into which Germany equally gradually slipped. In 1887, Bismarck had assured the Russian ambassador in Berlin that Germany had no objection to seeing the Russians masters of the Straits, possessors of the entrance to the Bosphorus and of Constantinople itself. But after the departure of Bismarck in 1890 and the slackening of the traditional tie to Russia, Germany's leaders sought closer links with Constantinople. Kaiser Wilhelm II made lavishly publicized journeys to the Ottoman Empire in October 1889 and again in October 1898. The gradual replacement of Britain by Germany as the guardian of the Straits at this particular juncture was of momentous importance, because it happened to coincide with the sundering of Europe into two alliance blocs. the question of the Turkish Straits, which had once helped to unify the European concert, was now ever more deeply implicated in the antagonisms of a bipolar system. Balkan helter-skelter. By the time the Ottomans sued for peace with Italy in the autumn of 1912, the preparations for a major Balkan conflict were already well underway. On the 28th of September 1911, the day Italy delivered its ultimatum to Constantinople, the Serbian foreign minister warned that if the Italo-Turkish war were to be protracted, it would inevitably bring Balkan repercussions. Almost as soon as the Italian declaration of war became known in October 1911, arrangements were put in train for a meeting between representatives of the Serbian and Bulgarian governments to discuss a joint military venture. The gradual replacement of Britain by Germany as the guardian of the Straits at this particular juncture was of momentous importance, because it happened to coincide with the sundering of Europe into two alliance blocs. The question of the Turkish Straits, which had once helped to unify the European concert, was now ever more deeply implicated in the antagonisms of a bipolar system. Balkan helter-skelter. By the time the Ottomans sued for peace with Italy in the autumn of 1912, the preparations for a major Balkan conflict were already well underway. On the 28th of September 1911, the day Italy delivered its ultimatum to Constantinople, the Serbian foreign minister warned that if the Italo-Turkish war were to be protracted, it would inevitably bring Balkan repercussions. Almost as soon as the Italian declaration of war became known in October 1911, arrangements were put in train for a meeting between representatives of the Serbian and Bulgarian governments to discuss a joint military venture. A first Serbian draft of a treaty of alliance with Bulgaria, spelling out the provisions for an offensive war against Turkey, was complete by November 1911. The defensive Serbo-Bulgarian alliance, signed in March 1912, was followed by an openly offensive one in May, just as Italy was seizing the Dodecanese. The Serbo-Bulgarian accords were focused mainly on military objectives against Ottoman southeastern Europe, but they also foresaw the possibility of combined action against Austria-Hungary. Around the Serbo-Bulgarian core, a secret Balkan League now coalesced, whose purpose was to expel the Turks from the peninsula. The peace negotiations between Italy and the Ottoman Empire were still dragging on when the League states began mobilizing for a general Balkan war. Hostilities opened on the 8th of October 1912, with a Montenegrin attack on Ottoman positions. On the 18th of October 1912, just as the Peace of Lausanne was being signed, King Petar I issued a royal declaration announcing that he had, by the grace of God, ordered his brave army to join in the holy war to free our brethren and to ensure a better future. The war that broke out in the Balkans in October 1912 had been foreseen by nearly everyone. What astonished contemporary observers was the swiftness and scope of the victories secured by the Balkan League states. Battles flared up across the peninsula as Serbian, Bulgarian, Greek, and Montenegrin armies advanced on the Ottoman strongholds. Geography dictated that the fulcrum of the Bulgarian war would be in eastern Thrace, whose broad, undulating plains narrow into the isthmus at the end of which Constantinople stands. Into this area the Bulgarians poured nearly 300,000 men, approximately 15% of the country's total male population. In all, just over 30% of Bulgarian males were mobilized during the First Balkan War. At Kirk Kilisa, Lotzengrad, a battle raged for 3 days along a 36-mile front stretching eastward from the Ottoman fortress of Edirne, Adrianople. Led by the exceptionally energetic Dmitriev, who was known as Napoleon on account both of his small stature and his preference for leading from the heat of battle, the Bulgarian infantry attacked with great determination and ferocity. When the Ottomans fell back in disarray, the Bulgarians followed through mud and heavy rain until they reached country for which they lacked good maps or reconnaissance, Their commanders had never expected them to get this far. The Bulgarian onslaught broke at last on the Chatalja line of fortifications, only 20 miles from Constantinople. Here, on the 17th of November 1912, with the capital city at their backs, the Ottomans held the line, deploying accurate artillery fire to inflict appalling casualties on the advancing lines of infantry and repelling wave after wave of assaults. This was as close as the Bulgarians would ever get to Constantinople. While the Bulgarians pushed into Thrace, the Serbian First Army advanced south into northern Macedonia with around 132,000 men. On the 22nd of October, earlier than they expected, they encountered an Ottoman force encamped around the town of Kumanova. On the following day, a battle broke out along a 10-mile front under cold, driving rain. After 2 days of fighting, the Serbs inflicted a crushing defeat on the Ottomans. There was no immediate follow-up, but the Serbian army drove on southwards, and in 3 days of sporadic but heavy fighting around the town of Prilep, again under the autumn rain, the Serbs once more drove the Ottoman troops from their positions. At the request of their Bulgarian allies, who were anxious to secure Salonika before the Greeks got their hands on it and had no further troops to spare, the Serbian command ordered the First Army on the 8th of November to advance on Bitola, a picturesque town on the river Dragor in southwestern Macedonia. Here the Ottomans had halted and consolidated their position, placing their artillery on the Oblakov Heights, overlooking the main approach from the north. Heavy artillery fire from the heights initially held the Serbs back. Only after the Oblakov Ridge was stormed and taken on the 17th of November did the tide of the battle turn decisively in the Serbs' favour. Firing with impressive skill from high ground, the Serbian artillery destroyed the Ottoman batteries defending the town, opening the way for an infantry assault that would turn the Ottoman flank. This was the last stand of the Ottomans in Macedonia, and in the meanwhile, the Serbian Third Army had advanced westwards into northern Albania, where they supported the Montenegrin army in besieging the fortified city of Skutari. From the beginning of the conflict, the Greeks had focused their attention single-mindedly on securing Salonika, the largest city of Macedonia and the key strategic port of the region. Leaving the Macedonian strongholds on their left flank to the Serbs and Bulgarians, the Greek army of Thessaly marched to the northeast, overrunning Ottoman positions on the Sarantaporos Pass and Yenitsa on the 22nd of October and the 2nd of November. The road to Salonika was now open. An almost comical interlude followed. During the first week of November, Greek units began surrounding the city. The Bulgarians, realizing that the Greeks were about to take this coveted prize, ordered their own 7th Rila Division to race southwards in the hope of preempting a Greek occupation, a deployment that forced them to leave Bitola to the Serbs. As they approached the city, messengers were sent ahead urging the Ottoman commander to surrender to the Bulgarian army under favorable terms. From the commander came the forlorn reply, "I have only one Thessaloniki, which I have already surrendered." The Greeks had got there first. Having initially refused the Bulgarians' entry, the Greek command eventually agreed to let 15,000 Bulgarians co-occupy the city with 25,000 Greek troops. In a parallel campaign waged in the Epirus, or southern Albania, the Greeks became bogged down in a siege of the well-fortified Ottoman positions around Yanina. The fighting dragged on in some areas, but the scale of the Allies' success was extraordinary. In only 6 weeks, they had conquered nearly half of all European Turkey. By the 3rd of December 1912, when an armistice was signed, the only points of continuing Ottoman resistance west of the Çatalca line were Adrianople, Yanina, and Skutari, all of which were still under siege. As the squabbling over Salonika suggests, the First Balkan War contained the seeds of a second conflict over the territorial spoils from the first. In the treaty founding their alliance in March 1912, Serbia and Bulgaria had agreed a clear plan of partition. The Bulgarians were to get southern Macedonia, including the towns of Ohrid, Prilep, and Bitola. Serbia was assigned Kosovo, heartland of the Serbian mythscape, and the Sanjak of Novi Pazar. Northern Macedonia, including the important town of Skopje, was assigned to a disputed zone. If the two parties failed to reach an agreement, they both undertook to accept the arbitration of the Russian Tsar. The Bulgarians were pleased with this agreement, especially as they expected the Russians to rule in their favour. The Serbs, by contrast, were far from happy. Many in the political elite felt that the March alliance, which had been negotiated by the moderate Prime Minister Milovan Milovanovic, had given too much away. Among the critics were the chief of the general staff Radomir Putnik and the radical party leader Nikola Pašić. "In my opinion," Pašić later commented, "we conceded too much, or better said, we abandoned some Serbian areas which we should never have dared to abandon, even if we were left without an agreement." A few months later, in July 1912, Milovanovic died unexpectedly, removing one of the chief exponents of moderation in Serbian foreign policy. 6 weeks after his death, the ardent nationalist Pašić took office as Prime Minister and Minister for Foreign Affairs. The first unequivocal sign that the Serbian government intended to breach the terms of the treaty with Bulgaria came even before the First Balkan War had broken out. On the 15th of September 1912, Pašić had dispatched a confidential circular to the Serbian delegations to the European powers, in which he referred to Old Serbia and defined this area as encompassing Prilep, Kičevo and Ohrid, areas that had been promised in March to Bulgaria. As the war got underway, Serbian designs on Macedonia were temporarily overshadowed by the advance into northern Albania, which distracted the leadership with the bewitching prospect of a port on the Adriatic. This was the old problem of Serbian national unification, that it could potentially involve expansion in a number of different directions, forcing decision-makers to choose between options. As soon as it became clear, however, that Austria-Hungary had no intention of allowing the Serbs to acquire a swathe of Albania, and the prospect of an Adriatic port receded from view, the leaders in Belgrade began to broach publicly the idea of revising the terms of the treaty with Bulgaria in Serbia's favour. A particular fetish was Monastir, which the Serbs had taken after repeated charges and heavy losses with the bayonet. Alarmed, the Bulgarians sent requests for clarification, which Pašić handled with his usual evasiveness. "All differences could and would be settled easily," he assured the Bulgarians, yet at the same time there was talk behind the scenes of annexing not just Prilep and Bitola from the Bulgarian zone, but also the hotly coveted city of Skopje in the disputed zone. Tempers were raised further by news of Serbian mistreatment of Bulgars in the liberated lands. It didn't help that the heir to the throne, Prince Alexander, had walked about various Macedonian towns during a tour of the conquered areas, engaging local Bulgars in the following formulaic dialogue: "What are you? Bulgarian. You are not Bulgarian. Fuck your father." It looked for some months as if a conflict might be avoided, because both Belgrade and Sofia agreed at the end of April 1913 to submit the Macedonian dispute to Russian arbitration. Anxious to bring the issue to a resolution, Sofia sent Dimitar Rizov, the Bulgarian diplomat who had assisted at the birth of the Serbian-Bulgarian Treaty of Alliance in 1904, see Chapter 2, to Belgrade to lay out the basis for an amicable settlement. Known as an exponent of Serbo-Bulgarian collaboration, Rizov was the right man to secure a deal, if any was to be had. But his conversations with the Serbian government convinced him that Belgrade had absolutely no intention of relinquishing any of the lands and strongholds that it currently held within the Bulgarian zone. He was particularly shocked at the influence wielded by the Russian minister. Hartvig's weight in Serbian affairs was such, he reported to the Bulgarian Prime Minister, that his diplomatic colleagues privately call him the regent, for, in reality, he fulfills the functions of the ailing Serbian king. On the 28th of May, one day after Rizov's departure from Belgrade, Pašić at last went public with his annexation policy, declaring before the Skupština that Serbia would keep all the lands it had fought so hard to acquire. Further conflict over Macedonia was now inevitable. In the last week of May 1913, large contingents of Serbian troops were moved to forward positions along the Bulgarian frontier, and the railways were temporarily closed to civilian traffic. On the 30th of June, Pašić was once again before the Skupština, defending his Macedonia policy against extreme nationalist deputies who argued that Serbia should simply have seized the captured provinces outright. Just as the debate was warming up, a messenger arrived to inform the Prime Minister that Bulgarian forces had attacked Serbian positions in the contested areas at 2 o'clock that morning. There had been no declaration of war. The Skupština erupted in uproar, and Pašić left the session to coordinate the government's preparations for a counter-offensive. In the inter-Allied war that followed, Serbia, Greece, Turkey, and Romania joined forces to tear chunks of territory out of the flanks of Bulgaria. Bulgarian forces entering Macedonia were checked by the Serbs on the river Bregalnica in early July. Then, well-dug-in Bulgarian troops around Kalimanci in northeastern Macedonia repelled a Serbian counterattack on the 15th to 18th of July and prevented the Serbs from invading western Bulgaria. While the Serbian front stagnated, the Greeks attacked from the south in a campaign that culminated in the bloody but inconclusive Battle of Kresna Gorja. At the same time, a Romanian assault in the east, which brought Romanian troops to within 7 miles of Sofia, forced the Bulgarian government to sue for an armistice. In the Peace of Bucharest, concluded on the 10th of August 1913, Bulgaria, after stupendous bloodletting, lost most of the territories it had acquired in the First War. The Wobbler. Russian policy on the Balkan events evolved in the shadow of the Bosnian annexation crisis of 1908-9. The Russians forgot, or never learned of, the role Izvolsky had played in proposing the exchange of Bosnia-Herzegovina for Austrian diplomatic support on the Straits question. The broader international context, the refusal of Britain, for example, to support the Russian bid for access to the Turkish Straits, was likewise elided from memory. Stripped down to serve the ends of nationalist and pan-Slavist propaganda, the Bosnian annexation was remembered as an infamous chapter in the history of Austrian perfidy, made worse by Germany's intervention in defense of its ally in March 1909. It was a humiliation, the like of which Russia must never again be made to endure. But the Bosnian debacle also revealed the extent of Russia's isolation in Balkan matters, for neither Britain nor France had shown much zeal in helping St. Petersburg to extricate itself from the mess that Izvolsky had helped to create. In future, it was clear, a way would have to be found of applying pressure in the region without alienating Russia's Western partners. The most striking feature of Russian Balkan policy in 1911-12 was the weakness of central control and coordination. Stolypin's assassination on the 18th of September 1911 plunged the system into disarray. The premier had been dead for just 10 days when the Italian government issued its ultimatum to the Ottoman government. The new premier, Vladimir Kakovtsev, was still finding his feet. Sazonov was abroad between March and December 1911, convalescing from a serious illness. In his absence, Assistant Foreign Minister Neratov struggled to stay abreast of developments. The reins of ministerial control slackened. The result was a fracturing of Russian policy into parallel and mutually incompatible elements. On the one hand, the Russian ambassador to Constantinople, Envy Charikhov, attempted to exploit the Ottoman Empire's predicament in order to negotiate improved conditions for Russian shipping in the Turkish Straits. As the Libyan crisis unfolded, Charikhov proposed to the Ottoman government that Russia guarantee Turkish possession of Constantinople, along with a defensible Thracian hinterland. In return, the Ottoman government would grant the Russians free passage for warships through the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus. At the very same time, Nikolai Hartwig, minister in Belgrade, pursued a very different line. Hartwig had been trained within the Asiatic department of the Russian Foreign Ministry, a subculture characterized by a preference for assertive positions and ruthless methods. Since his arrival in the Serbian capital in the autumn of 1909, he had been the champion of an active Russian policy on the Balkan Peninsula. He had made no effort to conceal his Austrophobe and Pan-Slav views. Andrei Toshev, the Bulgarian minister in the Serbian capital, was doubtless exaggerating when he claimed that, step by step, Hartwig took into his own hands